Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Donald Trump is forever reminding us that he's not Joe Biden. The current U.S. president claims his foreign policy is America first. But is it? Are Trump's policies just a continuation of Biden's? And what about the claim Trump is actually worse than Biden? Cross-talking Trump's foreign policy, I'm joined by my guest, Tariq Cyril Amar. He's in Istanbul. He's an historian and political commentator. And here in Moscow, we have Dmitry Babich. He is deputy foreign editor at Komsomolskaya Pravda Daily. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Tariq. You know, this debate going on, we're like 8 months in, and this is a Trump foreign policy. It's America first foreign policy. I'm sorry, I don't see a difference. I see a great deal of continuation. There are certain accents that are different than the Biden administration, but clearly it is a continuation. I would say that is irrefutable. Tariq.
Unfortunately, at this point, I have to agree with you. I think mostly that's true. Talking about accents, I would offer some of my own. I think it wouldn't be correct to say that it's even worse than Biden, because it's almost a philosophical question. You cannot be worse than Biden. But even reaching Biden level is horrible, right? And the other thing I would say is that it's interesting that from within the MAGA camp, we now have people criticizing the policy, especially towards Israel and Palestine. And we have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is suggesting that Trump shouldn't talk about America first any longer. He should talk about America only. And what she means by that, of course, is that she feels that Trump is not actually standing up for America in the first place. He's standing up for others, right? And she clearly means Israel in this case. I would add one last point. I don't want to take too much time. It may sound very pessimistic and sort of Leninist accelerationist, but I still see one advantage in Trump, and that is that he has become so brutal with the Europeans. And in the long run, I think it is actually helpful for the world if the symbiosis between the Western Europeans, I should say, and the United States is damaged and diminished.
Well, that brings up the point about Trump's seeking the Nobel Peace Prize in a very kind of perverse way that he should get it, because he's helped India, China, and Russia become closer together, along with Iran, and he's splitting the United States from Western Europe. That's possible. It'll make it a more peaceful world, but that's not obviously how Trump thinks about it. Dima, from a Russian perspective, how much different is Trump from Biden?
He is different because the United States stopped supplying the Ukrainian regimes with arms for free. And that's a huge difference. Okay, now it's NATO and the European allies or Washington who are paying for it. The amount is pretty much the same. Otherwise, the Ukrainian defense would have crumbled. But still, the fact that the burden now is on the main warmongers, on the real authors of all of these maths, that is a good development from a Russian point of view. Again, this is not something that Trump wanted. Trump wants a Nobel Peace Prize, and he, no less than Europeans, wants Russia exhausted. But I think I agree with Tariq. To a certain extent, the mere rudeness, the blatant character of Trump's foreign policy, it just makes the situation more clear. Now the people who keep calling the United States and the European Union the free world, now they look pathetic, you know. Just a few years, they stuck to this formula. Now it's just absurd. What are you talking about, you know? Peace-loving nations? You know, the zone of prosperity and stability. Look at Gaza, you know, look at their ally Israel, look at Ukraine, you know. So in a lot of ways, Trump helped the cause of peace, not by reducing the amounts of military activity, not reaching any stable agreements, but just by exposing, you know, how cynical the Western policy is.
Well, I mean, Tariq, I mean, it's one of these kind of paradoxes. I mean, Trump likes to be seen as a strong leader, forceful, consequential, but he's a bully. And, you know, you can get things done being a bully, but it has very little legitimacy whatsoever. I mean, for example, the American quiescence to Israel bombing Doha. Okay, I mean, that's not a strong person. That's a weak person.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, Trump, like Biden, in that respect, very similar, is extremely weak when it comes to Israel. He's so weak that it's natural that we ask ourselves what sort of pressure the Israelis can exert on this president as well. It's becoming absurd how American presidents let themselves be humiliated and serve the interests of Israel. I totally agree with you there. I would reinforce Dima's point, which is that there's something useful. I know he doesn't deserve praise for it, but there's something useful in Trump being such an unsophisticated bully, as it were. Because I would pick up on what you said as well there. The United States has always been a bully. What's so different about Trump is how incredibly brutal and in some ways short-sighted he is about it. The way he's alienated Doha, the way he's alienated the Indians, the way he treats China, the way he treats the Europeans, the way he treats Venezuela. He just can't stop, right? And in a way, this exposing that Dima pointed out, I think, is extremely useful for the world. It would have happened sooner or later, but it happens Trump to be doing it. And there's a direct connection, I think, to what you mentioned, Peter, as well, which is that he is so narcissistic. He does want to be the strong leader and to project that image. But together with his impatience, that produces this effect that he is just incredibly clear about how naked and cynical and also unproductive American power has become.
You know, there's so many, the Trump foreign policy is so convoluted, it's hard to separate things, because I think we're all in agreement that this symbiotic relationship the U.S. has had with Western Europe since the Second World War essentially is damaging European interests and American interests simultaneously. But he's actually doing that, okay? Again, it's very hard to parse these things, you know. And Dima, all through all of this, what is not convoluted is that to this day, Trump wants a better relationship with Russia. I truly believe that.
Well, the attitude of Russia changed as we realized, what sort of a mess the United States has become. Because in the early 90s, I think Yeltsin was sincere and he was speaking on behalf of many Russians when he said this infamous phrase, now quoted very often in Russia, God bless America and God bless Russia. Indeed, the Russian elite then hoped to have some kind of a friendly relationship with the United States. You can hear echoes of this even now, you know, when the Russian elite says, okay, with Europe it didn't play out, maybe with Trump it's going to play out. No, it's not going to play out with Trump. And it became obvious back in the 90s. But then, you know, Putin's attitude was pragmatic. He supported the American action in Afghanistan. Now many people forget it. Now, when people say, oh, Putin came to power in order to rebuild the Soviet Union, they miss so many facts. You know, Putin helped the United States in Afghanistan. Russia invested huge amounts of money in the World Cup, in the Olympic Games. We wanted to be a part of the West. Again, that was very sincere. Okay, maybe we didn't hope to be friends in the 2000s already, but we hoped for a pragmatic relationship. The problem is that the ideology pushed by Biden, by Obama, by the European leaders, it was not even greedy. It was not even pragmatic. They destroyed the Nord Stream bureaucratically, even before it was blown up physically. You know, the pipe was ready to function. They just didn't give it a paper, you know, that was needed in order for it to start functioning. So little by little, it became clear that you just cannot trust the United States. Even now, when they say, oh, Putin rejected Trump's deal. look, you know, Hamas hope to have a deal. You know, they assembled this doctor in order to discuss the deal with Israel pushed by Trump. And what did they get? You know, obviously,
well, I mean, Dima, knowing
about this missile.
Least we forget, Tariq, the same thing with Iran, you know, working with the IAEA, you know, in Geneva and all of this. And then even during negotiations, the United States conducted an unprovoked illegal attack on Iran. I mean, one of the caveats of the Trump administration's foreign policy is that if you think about negotiating with them, they might kill you.
Yes, quite literally. Absolutely. Yeah. And as you've pointed out, they have done it at least twice now. They've done it with Iran and they've done it with their own ally, Qatar, right? Which makes it in some ways even worse and more blatant. It's horrible in both cases. But of course, that is true. It is difficult to even have a theory, an explanation about how this comes together. How do the Trump people see the world? How do they engage with the world like this and expect any good outcomes, even for America? But
that's what I think. That's the overriding theme that we've had when we convene, is that you know, we can look at discrete actions and try to understand it, but in its totality, it's almost incomprehensible of what the strategy is. Keep going.
You know, I begin to feel that Trump cannot do strategy. I think that's one of the problems we see here, right? Trump can outsource strategy, maybe to people like Coolbridge for a while or something like that, but then he never leaves it in the same hands. He's never sure about who he wants to listen to. He doesn't have the ability to have strategy. The Chinese government has that ability. The Russian government has that ability, but I don't think the American government has that ability now under Trump. So the other thing I would add here is, look, we started with a comparison with Biden, and that's very legitimate, but the other thing is, why don't we also compare with what we may have expected from Trump? Because I think the one thing that the world and maybe people like us hoped for is that Trump at least wasn't enthralled to this sort of liberal centrist imperialism that says, you know, our values forever, we decide everything. When we negotiate, it basically means we tell you what to do and you say yes, right? And we saw Trump as an outsider, which of course he is in that respect. What is so incredibly disappointing about him is that he doesn't have any direction of his own, really. I would pick up on what you said earlier. I still think that Trump wants to be friends somehow with Russia and even with Putin personally. But the problem is, Trump has never become clear in his mind that the one thing that that takes, first of all, is to treat Russia as an equal. That's fundamental, and he cannot process that.
Well, he can't process respect. That's it's the problem. I mean, you disagree with me? How can you disagree with me? Yeah. I want to be your friend, but you disagree with me. You can't conduct foreign relations that way. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's foreign policy. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the Trump presidency. One of the nuances or accents, I think, that we used in the first part of the program, there seems to me a resource allocation difference from this administration, from the Biden administration. What do I mean by that? I'm not really sure what Marco Rubio does as Secretary of State or National Security Advisor, but he certainly is really interested in the Western Hemisphere, and he's certainly interested in Venezuela. So he's kind of the minister at large for the hemisphere. But then add to that another data point is Israel. You know, it seems to me, considering they want Trump is a voice, who knows with how much thought in mind, you know, we have Gaza Largo, the Israeli attack on Doha and Qatar. He's farmed out that part of his foreign policy to Israel. What Israel will lead, America will follow. In the meantime, Trump is interested in the Panama Canal. He's interested in Greenland. He's interested in Canada. Not so much recently. We'll see if that remains the same. But there seems to be an allocation, a resource allocation division going on here. What are your thoughts?
Well, indeed, it's obvious that Rubio wants to go down in history as someone who changed the regime in at least one Latin American country, you know, taking
it. Yes, but he'll also go down in history as an architect of genocide. Keep going, Dima.
Exactly. But, you know, the problem is that we are returning to the early 20th century capitalism. They forget, you know, that the reason why Castro won in Cuba, the reason why Hugo Chavez came to power in Venezuela, was the shameless way in which the multinational companies treated these countries. The kind of capitalism that they built there was very much like the American capitalism of the 1920s and the Great Depression period. So, unfortunately, we know that one of the reasons for that was the absence of the counterweight, which used to be the Soviet Union. So when Putin says, and the West blames him terribly for that, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union was the main tragedy, the main disaster of the 20th century. Well, if indeed this all leads to the rebirth of pre-welfare capitalism, then indeed it was the main disaster of the 20th century, because the main achievement of the 20th century was the creation of welfare societies and relative peace, which reigned at least between Western Europe, the United States, and the Soviet Union in the second half of the 20th century. Unfortunately, the Cold War, as we know, cost a lot more dearly to nations that could not control their territories. You know, people in Africa suffered because of that war. People in Nicaragua and other Latin American
countries
suffered because of that war. Vietnam. Now, unfortunately, and this is the tragedy for Russians, it moved to the Soviet Union. You know, Ukraine is suffering for exactly the same reasons why Africa was suffering during the Cold War. The United States and Europeans are using them in the same way as they used, I don't know, Angola or you know, other countries next to South Africa. So in a way, we see this tragedy unfolding. By the way, the sphere of Russian influence shrank, so now we only have Belarus in the same position as socialist Poland, communist Hungary, you know, in the times of the Cold War. They lived very modest lives, but at least they were safe. You know, everyone understood no one is going to hit them until they are under protection of the Soviet Union. So in that sense, Lukashenko is much wiser than the leaders of Ukraine, which, you know, because socialist Poland is, of course, better than Africa during times of the Cold War, or war in African states. So basically, what we see is a huge regress. You know, humanity.
Well, Orva, that's a really interesting regress. See, that I've been grappling with this study because I would agree it's a regression if we take the 20th century, particularly the second half of the 20th century, as a norm. But then you could also make the argument that the second half of the 20th century was an anomaly, that there were actually Trump unknowingly is bringing the world back to great power politics, okay? And what great powers learned is that you better not get into a fight with each other because you might lose, okay? The First World War proved that. So, you know, it seems to me that we're going back to great power politics, and I guess all three of us would agree, without all of the verbiage of the rules-based order. I welcome the end of that rhetoric, but great power politics is problematic too. Tariq?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that point that you've just made is something that's sometimes lost today for understandable reasons. People are desperate about the world as it is now. You've mentioned Gaza, which is really the peak indicator of just how incredibly brutal and criminal our world has become. This is 23 months of genocide now, supported by the West. and not stopped by anybody else. So it's understandable that people try to look forward to some sort of hope for the future. And that's where a certain romanticization of the idea of multipolarity comes in. And I get that. I am a great fan of multipolarity. I think it has to come back. But I don't think people should expect miracles. I think it is much more likely to be what you've described, a return to multipolar great power politics. And the one thing it will do is not allow one great power to be as criminal as the United States and its ally Israel are at this particular moment, because they might run into too much trouble from the others, right? But that's balance of power. That is balance of power, and the world has seen it before. I would vastly prefer it to the so-called unipolar moment and its illusions, which has broken down, right? We are looking for the world after the unipolar moment. We are already in it, but it doesn't have a shape yet that has settled, right? And I would also prefer it actually to the world of the Cold War, although I grew up in it, which was a bipolar world, but also full of injustices if you were in the wrong place, right?
Right.
So I would say that, unfortunately, what is so disappointing about Trump, to come back to this, is that the best case scenario for Trump 2.0 would have been that he would have been ready to take the United States in the direction of being one major great power among, say, five. If he had sort of agreed to that, to say, I make America great again, but the way I do it, I will finally really abandon the illusions of multipolarity, of being indispensable, of being somehow special. I will make America one major power among a handful. That would have been the best possible outcome, and clearly Trump doesn't grasp this.
Yeah, and another huge casualty, and this has been a progression, is the UN Charter. Depending on if it's an odd day or an even day of the week, I have certain attitudes about the United Nations, but I don't have a bad attitude about the Charter. Yeah. I think the organization should be revamped, should be moved to the Global South, where it belongs now. But that is one of the great casualties of the unipolar moment and America grappling with losing that prestigious status. And we have the rule of law is dead. That is something that was one of the positives that we got from the 20th century. When we have Israeli officials say, well, you bombed Dresden. I mean, but that's why we have international law, not to do that again. Okay. Mm-hmm. All of that is washed. It's amazing. In a few short months, 23 months, the very concept of international law has just been destroyed. Dima.
It's true. We have here this play of words, the rule of law, international law, and the rules-based order. You know, rules does not equal law, you know. Yeah. So in this way, Russia made every effort to preserve international law, and not only Russia. Basically, if you look at the elites of China, Arab countries, Turkey, during the 90s, in the 2000s, they all tried to please the West. They tried to be part of the West. In that sense, Russia was no exception. I think historians will have to solve this problem. How come that the West, having all the cards, as Trump now says, in the 90s, been in such a good position, managed to antagonize these countries, managed to antagonize even the elites, you know, because, the nations were always suspicious of the United States. But the elites, even in Palestine, you know, we all remember Arafat and what kind of discussions that were going inside the Palestinian elite at the time. So historians will have to pass a judgment on that. But now we see there is no trust. People don't trust neither Trump nor Ursula von der Leyen. These people lost credibility. So when they say, Russia must have a new president and then we can have business. India must have a new prime minister. No, you must have new leaders. Because the current leaders have discredited themselves completely.
Well, that's a really good point. Again, if things are so convoluted, I mean, Tariq, I mean, one of the positives, and I say that in air quotes, is we see the self-destruction of European elites.
Yes, they have lost all respect and all credibility, certainly internationally. And I think the process inside European societies is much more advanced than we know, because there's still a lot of mainstream media control and the facade is still up, right? But if you look at Britain, France, Germany, three key powers shaping that sort of EU, NATO, Europe, you know, they're all on the verge of new right takeovers, actually. And whether you like the new right or not, the causality behind that is that the center has lost, and not only in terms of political weight, it has lost, as you say, all credibility. People just won't buy it anymore, what they're getting from these people, right? That's one thing. But one thing I would also like to say is I do think it's important to make a distinction between the rule of international law and international law itself. I agree with both of you, I think, that the rule of international law has been destroyed, and it has been destroyed by the West. We have done that, right? The US has done that and its European vassals together. But international law, after all, is something else. It's a body of thought, it's a body of doctrine, and it's still there. And there is a good reason that some people still talk about it. I think what this moment really needs is what Dima pointed out, make the distinction clear to everybody between the so-called rules-based order and international law. They're not at all the same. The rules-based order was invented to avoid international law. Exactly. And in a way, we are lucky about that, because if they had committed all their crimes in the name of international law, they would have done even more damage to it.
Okay, very rarely does this program end on a positive note, but Tariq did it. He ended on a positive. I want to thank Tariq and Dima. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.